Good morning, and welcome to day two of our Character and the Professions Conference. We're delighted to have you with us here this morning. Almost 2,300 people from 37 countries across six continents have registered for this conference, so we're very glad that you are among them. My name is Michael Lamb, and I'm Executive Director of the Program for Leadership and Character and Assistant Professor of Interdisciplinary Humanities here at Wake Forest. And on behalf of our Program for Leadership and Character and the Oxford Character Project, I'm pleased to welcome you to our session this morning on character and religious leadership. We will hear a keynote address from Dean Jonathan Lee Walton from Wake Forest, followed by a panel of distinguished leaders and scholars from various traditions, sharing their own perspectives on character in religious life. Now, it's my distinct honor to introduce my colleague and friend, Dean Jonathan Lee Walton. Dean Walton is Dean of Wake Forest School of Divinity, Dean of Wake Chapel, and Presidential Chair in Religion Society here at Wake Forest. Prior to joining Wake Forest, he was a Plummer Professor of Christian Morals and the Pusey Minister at the Memorial Church at Harvard University. A leading scholar of religion and social ethics, he's the author of Watch This, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Black Televangelism, and most recently, A Lens of Love, Reading the Bible in Its World for Our World. His talk today is entitled, Blessed Be the Neoliberal Tie That Binds? The Common Good in a Privatized Age. Welcome, Dean Walton.
Thank you, Michael. Let me begin with just profound words of appreciation to the Center for Leadership and Character at Wake Forest University. Thank you for providing this very necessary platform to discuss such a timely topic. I'm also just so impressed and inspired by your leadership, Michael Lamb, as well as the leadership of Kenneth Townsend, Molly Cosby, and the entire staff of the program in Leadership and Character. As stated, my lecture title this morning is entitled, Blessed Be the Neoliberal Tie That Binds. Blessed be the neoliberal tie that binds. The common good in a privatized age. My friends, a few years ago, I received one of the most significant honors of my professional career. My alma mater, Morehouse College, awarded me the Benjamin Elijah Mays Leadership Award in Religion. Named for former Morehouse president, Baptist minister, scholar of religion, and the man historian Randall Jelks refers to as the schoolmaster of the civil rights movement. Benjamin Elijah Mays, this award, it held special significance. For me, few others in American history typify moral and ethical leadership like Benjamin Elijah Mays. Mays held multiple worlds in dialectic tension. Paideia and phronesis, intellectual cultivation and practical wisdom, erudition and empathy. He leveraged lofty ideals and sophisticated theoretical constructs to empower everyday people crushed by the quotidian weight of structural inequality. And the transcendent with the immanent. Though he had extraordinary spiritual gravitas, he consistently challenged those who sought to be so heavenly minded that they were no earthly good. This is why generations of students, funded by numerous foundation scholarships that Benjamin Mays helped to establish, they continue his legacy of service in all fields of human endeavor. In fact, if it had not been for the influence of Benjamin Mays on the life of a student who enrolled at Morehouse in 1944 to become a lawyer, the world may have never known the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Arguably, no other minister or educator has had made a more profound impact on King than Benjamin Elijah Mays. Thus, the reason why that weekend was such a memorable and meaningful occasion for me. Couple this with the fact that my fellow honorees included R&B superstar Usher, my wife's not so secret crush, along with filmmaker Tyler Perry and Warner Brother Music CEO John Platt. It was also a humbling celebration, for this was one occasion where I was 100% positive that nobody gathered, including my own family, was interested in me. Yet after multiple events over a couple of days, a young man approached me. He introduced himself as a senior religion major at Morehouse. He was on the slight side physically, maybe 5'4", 5'5", possibly 120 pounds, fully dressed. He was kind and curious, though he was also quite demure, even diffident in his demeanor and his disposition. He said to me, he said, sir, I'm impressed by all that you've accomplished. I was wondering if you might offer me some advice. Can you tell me what I can do to expand my brand? Can you tell me what I can do to expand my brand? I immediately took offense. I asked him, I said, you want to go to seminary, right? He said, yes. You want a career in ministry? He said, yes. You feel God's call on your life? Yes, sir, he replied. Well, I need you to remember this, I told him. The kingdom of God is not a brand. And for good measure, I added a line that Dr. Mays often offered aspiring ministers at Morehouse. Preachers ought to be more concerned with their service to humanity than the wheelbase of their luxury cars. And with that, I picked up my award. I strutted off in my little tight tuxedo with what I now believe was undoubtedly all of the smug self-righteousness that I could muster. My friends, I share this story to adumbrate what I deemed the prevailing pressures and perils confronting today's religious professionals. Let me begin with the pressures. What do I mean by pressure? By pressure, I'm referring to the social, cultural, and economic forces that form and shape our moral dispositions and direct our ethical compasses. We're all moral agents. Yet each of us make choices under conditions not of our own choosing. And such pressures and social forces are realities that all of us must acknowledge. For example, the other evening while moderating a small group called the Conversations to kick off this conference, in fact, one question caused the group to come alive. It wasn't the question, what ought integrity and character look like? Well, we all have examples of people like Benjamin Elijah Mays, John Lewis, Pauli Murray, Abraham Joshua Heschel, Dorothy Day, and Eboo Patel, people of moral character, courage, and compassion who leave lasting legacies. It's easy to point to a Jill Crenshaw, Stephanie Pinder Amaker, a Deb Richardson Moore, a Sharon Watson Fluker, highly productive professionals that exude empathy, decency, and integrity. At the same time, it's not hard to identify when there's a void of professional character integrity. Dishonesty, gossip, greed, and unbridled will to power. But the other night, the conversation really got going, not when we considered the attributes of good character and not when we considered those who are jerks. But the conversation sparked, came alive when we discussed the cultural and professional pressures that undercut virtue and even encourage vice. Social, cultural, political pressures which extinguish and asphyxiate our moral imaginations and our virtuous habits. And when I think back on my encounter with that precious young man. I now have a theory. I would argue that his moral imagination, like the moral imagination of so many of us who have come of age in the context of a particular form of late unembedded capitalism, we've been fundamentally shaped to view the professional self as a privatized commodity within a hyper-competitive brand market. What can I do to expand my brand? What can I do to expand my brand? Friends, when did this become the fundamental question of the ethical life? Not what shall I be, like students of Aristotle in the Lyceum, students consumed with what the Greeks called arete, or excellence, also translated as virtue. Not what shall I do, the Swahili principle of ujima, collective work and responsibility, a principle expressed best in the maxim, if you want to go fast, go alone, but if you want to go far, go together. And not how shall we heal, as conveyed by the Hebrew principle, tikkun olam, or repairing the world. It teaches us that we ought to reject all forms of idolatry, knowing that all things belong to God, not us. And thus, we're all just stewards of God's creation. No, that young man was representative of so many of us who have been morally formed over the past four decades by a hegemonic structure of neoliberalism. And I want to suggest today that this was his pressure. This is our pressure. Neoliberal economic, political, and cultural logics constitute the not so invisible force that binds us together and can morally and socially tear us apart. Well, let me concede by saying that I understand that the term neoliberalism has become an academic slur of sorts. It can land on so many people like the word heresy or heretic. It's a convenient catch-all denunciation of whatever and whomever one does not agree with at any given point. Much of this has to do with the theoretical slippage that often lies beneath its use. Neoliberalism becomes an imprecise synonym for economic inequality, globalization, corporatism, plutocracy, and any other feature of a particular type of governmentality that may capture certain symptoms while failing to convey a substantive definition. Some have even said that neoliberalism escapes definition altogether. But if something is everything, then it's nothing at all. So define we must. For my purposes today, by neoliberalism, I am referring to a theory of political and economic practices, cultural practices, that assumes that states best promote human well-being by promoting individual entrepreneurial freedoms within an institutional framework that emphasizes free markets, free trade, and private property. And where there are no markets, government should incentivize and create markets. Historian Daniel Stedman Jones offers an instructive genealogy of neoliberalism in his incredible book, Masters of the Universe. He defines the development into three distinct phases. The first phase, beginning in interwar Europe between 1920 and 1950 with Austrian economists and German ordo liberals, a school of thought that strongly emphasized market competition and promoting international trade to maximize competition. This earliest phase included a wide array of thinkers. They range from Austrian classical liberal economist Friedrich Hayek and Hungarian British polymath, Carl Polanyi. While some lean toward a more laissez-faire approach of classical liberalism, others believe that a state should play a more interventionist role in capitalist economies, lest freedom become a wild horse with no destination. But where they all agreed was their strident opposition to socialism. And they also believed at this particular juncture that the consolidation and concentration of economic power precipitates fascism, particularly as witnessed in Germany. Well, it was in 1938 at a conference in Paris that participants adopted the term neoliberal. Here, they conceived of neoliberalism as a synthesis emerging from the dialectic of state-planned economies and the laissez-faire nature of classical liberal economics. Though control of the market was an anathema to economists like Hayek and University of Chicago's Milton Friedman, a laissez-faire approach did not convince them as effective enough. Markets needed strong protection. They needed even promotion. So rather than regulating the market, these earliest thinkers envisioned governments taking an active role to liberate, guarantee, and protect, and in some cases, even incentivize. And so beginning in the 1950s with what Jones describes as the second phase, neoliberalism proved a gadfly to New Deal liberalism and Keynesian approaches to economic policy in the United States and in Britain. And over the next three decades, neoliberalism developed into a coherent set of practical ideas, and people in business and finance, economists and preachers all contributed to this turn. By framing free markets as quintessentially American and indistinguishable from popular notions of freedom, liberty, and individualism, market regulation, trade unionism, and any other structures that might embed markets into a structure of accountability became viewed as anti-American and anti-freedom. And this ushers in this third and final phase that many believe we're in now around 1980 with the elections of British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and United States President Ronald Reagan. For during this phase, the process of neoliberalization became more than a political or economic project. It became a cultural reality insofar as the principles of individualism and competition became all-encompassing. At its root, there is an assumption, to quote former British Prime Minister Thatcher, that there's no such thing as a society. Only individual men and women. And so, as an ideology, neoliberalism is based on a conception of human freedom and individual liberty that views humans as self-interested rational actors in a competitive marketplace. Homo economicus, that's who we are. A fundamental belief that free markets facilitate human flourishing. So there's a need for government policies to protect and preserve free markets by eradicating regulations and controls. Neoliberalism promotes the creation of competitive markets, even where there were none. And such a common sense view of Homo economicus that frames each of us as competitors within a ubiquitous marketplace provides this foundational pillar and pressure of our modern life. Because insofar as a notion of competition replaces exchange within a capitalist economy, the assumption of inequality can also and has replaced equality. And this may explain why more than a few theorists have described this most recent form of capitalism as a winner-takes-all economy, bolstered by a winner-takes-all politics that has shaped a winner-take-all society. It's the ruling ideology or pressure of our age, which all of us must contend. It constitutes the cultural habitus in which leadership values are extolled and character habits are formed. Thus, there should be little surprise that institutional brands have supplanted institutional value. Well, conservative political theorist Yuval Levin, he makes this argument in his latest book, A Time to Build. Levin laments the decline of institutions, which he refers to as durable forms of our common life. They're the frameworks or structures of what we do together. Levin contends, and I agree with him, that institutions play a valuable formative role. They offer us structures of accountability and they orient us toward causes more significant than the self. It's our institutions that engender collective effort. They enable the completion of a collective task. In turn, institutions habituate character dispositions that help vaccinate us from the vices of unbridled individualism, avarice, egoism, and cultural cutthroat ambition. With this brother, I agree. But what I find fascinating and convicting is how he, like so many of us, fail to consider the cultural pressures that contribute to the problem. His diagnosis of the symptom or symptoms are spot on. Whether the halls of Congress, elite academic institutions, or religious bodies, institutions merely provide platforms to enhance our brand value in a competitive marketplace of humanity. And in his words, institutions are no longer formative spaces, they're just performative spaces. Platforms for us to increase our brand. But why should we ignore the cultural and economic forces that facilitated such an ethical turn to the self? That young man's question to me, what can I do to expand my brand, was, I argue, a sincere articulation and reflection of the cultural pressure born of the moment. And this leads me to my next point. I want to suggest that as religious leaders, we ignore these pressures at our own moral peril. We ignore these pressures at our own moral peril. And can I confess right now that herein lies the problem with my self-righteous, sanctimonious response to that young man's question? The kingdom of God is not a brand, I declared. That's true. And it made for a cute quip. But he wasn't talking about the kingdom of God. He was talking about me. Somebody who on that weekend was being awarded and recognized for religious leadership. Somebody who in his eyes, and probably in the eyes of the selection committee, had attended all the right private schools, earned the appropriate degrees, taught at elite universities, and preached from prominent pulpits. Somebody who from prevailing successful brand standards presented as sufficiently bourgeois, appropriately masculine, ostensibly heterosexual, convincingly articulate, and presumably well-connected. So with his question, that young man named what I would have preferred to conveniently ignore. I had been branded. And those brand markers that I just referenced quite possibly had as much to do with my leadership and character in the eyes of the public as any acts of integrity, generosity, and empathy that I sought to live out in private. So rather than acknowledging the dangers of such personal privilege, I deflected and I denied. The kingdom of God is not a brand. Now, please excuse me while I go dine with Usher. I dismissed and derailed an opportunity to engage this young man about the assumptions that informed his question. And maybe it's because it was easier for me to turn a blind eye to the cultural conditions that contributed to my professional success and presumed virtue. Even as these same cultural conditions, unfortunately, frustrate the professional aspirations of the vast majority of others. The kingdom of God is not a brand. That's what I said. But who is to say that most religious professionals are not animated by service, intellectually, that they're not intellectually curious, that they're not nobly empathetic, and that they're not sacrificially committed to a life of dutiful service to God and humanity? Most, including this young man, very well may be virtuous in aim and intent. But what does that mean when a prevailing culture of religious disaffiliation and non-civic participation, born of our interior turn to the self, has gutted traditional forms of professional opportunities for talented and sincere religious professionals? No wonder this young man is asking the question of me, how do I expand my brand? And if we fail to consider, like I did that night, the cultural impact on the moral lives of religious professionals, then we fail to do so at all of our own peril. Because an emerging generation wants more from us than platitudes. They are working, they are serving, they are ministering, and often it seems like it's all for naught. Last week, as an example, I spent an evening with Provost Rogan Kirsch, discussing the trend of religious nuns among millennials. I was with his extraordinary students. We were talking about this phenomenon of the nuns. Social scientists generally define nuns as adults who describe their religious identity as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. And in this country, we've witnessed decade over decade growth among this population. And what's also interesting about this population, a critical mass of them profess a belief in God, yet choose not to affiliate with any religious community. We often refer to them as the spiritual but not religious crowd. Unfortunately, we also know that non-religious affiliation reflects a more significant trend identified in the final quarter of the previous century. the downward trend of face-to-face community interactions, a trend born of decreased significance of social institutions, institutions that bring people together, like Levin argues. Religious congregations, they proved one of the few bastions of community engagement. And as Robert Putnam says, bonding social capital. Yet when people neglect religious association, we also see in the data that they negate civic participation. And today, this morning, I want to ask, can we ignore the correlation between disaffiliation, particularly under the guise of spiritual but not religious, and not see the correlation with the privatization of religion born of neoliberal hegemony? Spiritual connotes the interiorization of religious faith that undercuts group solidarity and social commitments. This private spirituality aligns well with the multi-billion dollar self-improvement industry, even as it fractures social bonds born of religious service and civic participation. And this places today's religious professional in a paradox. Decreased religious attendance translates into decreased wages, fewer employment opportunities, and diminished resources, while also contributing to higher rates of loneliness, depression, and deaths of despair among the communities that religious professionals are called to serve. So this is a clear example of one area where the markets are incorrect. The market would say that there's not a need for robust religious professionals with pastoral care sensibilities because of disaffiliation and the dearth or decline of religious institutions. But the dearth and decline of religious institutions is actually contributing to the social misery that demands and necessitates the work of religious professionals and pastoral care counselors. This is the paradox that our students at the Divinity School, this is the paradox that religious professionals are facing. Born of the logics of a hyper-individualist, ultra-competitive culture that's become the source of so much suffering among millennials. And finally, my friends, the predicament of today's religious professionals underscores the folly of placing a market value on all features of human life. My response to that young man, though not very generous and not very self-aware, but at its best, my response to that young man was trying to impress that simple point, that there are some things that we cannot place market value on. I know the culture is trying to get us to adhere to the logics that seem to just make common sense. Know your market value, and then do what you need to do to enhance your competitive edge and increase your market worth. But just because a particular ideology has come to connote common sense does not mean that it reflects good sense. We know that free market fundamentalism and privatization under the euphemism of freedom, they have all enhanced the worst features of American individualism. Now, I know when we talk about individualism, as the French theorist Alexis de Tocqueville pointed out in his classic text on democracy, a focus on individual aspiration has defined American culture since its beginning. but privatization as a core tenet of today's cultural logic has expanded into interpersonal life in ways that we've never seen before. Whereas individualism historically came with expectations of group loyalty and interdependence, neoliberalization has radicalized individualism. Competition engenders calculating forms of existence while placing full responsibility for failure or success on an individual's shoulders. And we wonder why that perceived failure is now hypermoralized among millennials. Of course, again, another source of increased levels of anxiety, depression, isolation, and loneliness. And in regards to our perceived success, in the words of philosopher Michael Sandel, the more we think of ourselves as self-made, self-sufficient, the harder it is to learn gratitude and humility. And without gratitude and humility, it's hard to care for the common good. I want to close this lecture by sharing, in preparation for this talk, I read Oscar Wilde's macabre novel. It's entitled The Picture of Dorian Gray. It's a hedonistic tale set in the late 19th century where an otherwise beautiful young man makes a Faustian bargain. When he sees his beauty, his youth, reflected back to him in a painting produced by a friend, Dorian Gray chooses to trade his soul to retain the physical beauty of the portrait that he sees before him. He makes this deal, a deal that the portrait will age, but not beautiful Dorian. Well, Dorian Gray soon falls under the influence of a hedonistic, self-indulgent aristocrat philosopher. His name was Lord Henry. And Lord Henry encouraged Dorian to take advantage of his beauty, take advantage to this gift that you have to the world. Lay claim to all the world has to offer you. Maximize it. Feed your insatiable impulses. Wilde describes Lord Henry as a man who knows the value of everything, or the price of everything, but the value of nothing. He knows the price of everything, but the value of nothing. Well, Dorian Gray goes on to believe for the next few decades that he's living the life of Riley. He indulges, he takes advantage of his youth, his beauty, his brand, that everybody wants to be near him, and he takes advantage and exploits everyone, including himself in the process. And with each passing year, as he spirals downward into debauchery and concupiscence, the once beautiful face of the portrait becomes increasingly gruesome. He tries to cover up the portrait. He tries to conceal the gluttony and the lechery on the face. But no matter what happens, no matter the deceptive prosperity that Dorian Gray sees upon his individual brow when he looks in the mirror, the portrait reflects his true misery. I believe that this is the responsibility of religious professionals today. It's incumbent upon us as religious professionals to help our communities lift that covering to open that closet, to reveal that portrait. It's incumbent upon us to help our community see the social implications of our privatized decay, to show leadership and character in our profession is to courageously and candidly identify the cultural pressures that undercut and asphyxiate leadership and character. For each one of us is born part saint and one part gangster. And so we have to do a better job of identifying the systems that promote our gangsterism, rather than veiling it within a cloak of sainthood. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Dean Walton, for a really terrific, terrific talk. I think you've offered a powerful vision, prophetic vision of what our common good should be and how we can begin to work to seek it in the ways that actually look at ourselves and our society with clear eyes and hopefully some compassion. So thank you very much for that vision, Dean Walton. We do have time for questions from the audience. Some of you already submitted questions using the Q&A function. If you want to submit a question, use the Q&A function there on Zoom. And we'll field those for Dean Walton directly. So Dean Walton, we have one question already from the audience I'd like to ask you. It comes from Tom Jennings. And he says that many see a major difference between Asian cultures and Western cultures, and that some Asian cultures often put the common good above individual good. They're more willing to isolate, war, and wear masks, for example, to protect others than exercise individual freedom to go out or be maskless during today's pandemic. What can we learn from Asian cultures to improve our own society?
Well, it's a great question. I think also the answer is embedded in the question, which I appreciate. And that shows how much we actually do have to learn from other cultures and other societies. Rather than taking a simply exceptionalist and triumphalist view of our society as if that we only can export moral values and virtues and not import moral values and virtues. But at the same time, we also have to be very cognizant of the ways that what I talked about today is also a growing global reality. So whether we're talking about varying parts of Asia, whether we're talking about West Africa, whether we're talking about the global South, we see varying forms of this kind of hyper-individuality taking form, particularly even in our religious communities. For example, I would think about the spread of what's often referred to as the prosperity gospel on a global scale, the evangelical prosperity gospel that kind of promotes this conception or view of hyper-individuality tied to a spirituality premised upon material blessings. And we know that that is taking off on a global scale. So I think the question is absolutely correct in terms of what we have to learn from other cultures and traditions, as well as keeping track and being mindful of the ways that these are cultural realities that traverse the boundaries of culture. I think you're still muted, Brother Michael. I see you talking to me.
Thank you, Jonathan. You get the question out here. So the next one comes from Melissa Jenkins, who asks, you know, especially giving a reference to Oscar Wilde, who was imprisoned for homosexual acts. Some people are moving away from some segments of some churches because they feel that the church has rejected them rather than the other way around. So what can we do about that, if anything, to respond to pressures you identify?
Mm-hmm. And that absolutely is one of the trends that people have identified with the growing religious disaffiliation. People have put their finger on that it's a kind of exclusionary culture where so many religious traditions have seemed to cast their anchors in harbors of exclusion and intolerance based upon regressive views of gender, of sexuality, of race and ethnicity. And that has pushed many young people away. not to mention that many of the studies that Pew and others have done, that they have seen that what some have perceived as an establishment of religion, insofar as certain religious groups have aligned with particular political parties, not just in this country, but other countries, that that has become a source of disdain that have caused many millennials to look at communities of faith with great contempt. And so that is something that we have to address, that we have to understand that if we're fundamentally grounded in theologies of love, then love builds out, right? That love builds out, that love makes room, that love makes space, rather than gathering our theological wagons around toxic theologies that privilege particular groups of people based upon accidents of birth.
Well, in light of that, Dean Walton, I have a question from Caroline Thompson about love and compassion. She asks, looking at leaders of religions, how might religious leaders cultivate compassion within themselves, both physically and spiritually, so we may go forward and extend that compassion to others? How might we compassionately expose the harm done by our society within ourselves, so we may empathetically receive others in the midst of their pain?
That's another, I mean, these questions are so incredible. There's these moments that I listen to these questions, right, and I'm being informed by them. I'm appreciative of them because I'm being informed by them, and they're so spot on. I would say that one of the things that I would want to suggest that many have is that even in this kind of hyper-competitive world that we're always thinking about expanding our brand, that a certain urgency of now and tyranny of busyness is actually turning us away from a spiritual life. And when I have a critique of the spiritual but not religious category, that is not to say that I am not suggesting that there shouldn't be spiritual cultivation. To the contrary, to develop the sorts of moral dispositions and habits that we talked about, we have to be able to spend time with the self. We have to become more self-aware, more self-critical. And in some ways, I guess, now that I'm thinking about it, I guess that's what I was even trying to do with this lecture. Taking some time to reflect on my knee-jerk reaction to that young man and my inability to critique in that moment, and thus, therefore, not be able to empathize with him. But as you know, Brother Michael, all of these things come through a process of habituation. It's a matter of how we are able to practice, right? And so what my mother used to tell me in terms of fake it until you make it, right? Well, that's not just a dismissive, you know, quip. No, there's something really morally virtuous and valuable about that, because that is how we engender the sorts of demeanors and dispositions that make us more compassionate, make us more loving, make us more kind. How do we become that? By being more compassionate, by being more loving, by being more kind, faking it sometimes until we actually make it.
Excellent. Well, one way we do that, at least in communities of faith, is through ritual and worship practices there. So one question from Christopher Leonard is this: how do you think about the rise of individualism and how has it affected the exercise of worship itself? Over time, it seems that the church services, even hymns and worship songs themselves, have become more and more about the individual attending than about the divine being we worship in church. What's the best way to counter this?
Sometimes we have to name the trends. We have to name the trends. I mean, even the ways that our language has changed within worship, and even the spaces in which we worship. Right? Narthex, sanctuary, chancel, right, have been replaced and supplanted by lobby, auditorium, stage. Stage signifying levels of performativity. And if it's performativity and performance, that undercuts ritual corporate participation. And so we go to see a show rather than actually participate in religious ritual and corporate worship. And it's not just about even the lobby auditorium and the stage. Even add to that, think about many of our churches now, congregations, particularly in the evangelical world, you see screens up on multiple sides. Right? And so collective singing has been replaced by viewing screens. And so it's a form of televangelism incarnate within the space where we're in a worship space together, yet consuming individually alone as if we were in the comforts of our own home. And so the very structures of worship could actually facilitate rituals that render us alone together.
Thanks, Dean Walton. A question from David Householder about how the extremes of neoliberalism might lead to pretty dangerous results. But he asks, is there not a point where some of the truths of neoliberalism actually do promote measurable and perhaps unparalleled levels of human flourishing and emergence of middle class, especially in the global South? How would you respond to that, the question of whether or not that actually could be a helpful way to sort of address issues of poverty and disease?
Help me with this, Michael. When we think of where virtue lies, right? Virtue lies between polarizing vices, right? Of excess and deficiency. And so we always look for that median, but that median isn't just in a averaged middle. That median is based upon keeping tracks of the excesses as well as the deficiencies. And that is how I would respond to that question as it relates to neoliberalism. What I'm trying to do here is keep up with what we know to be the excesses, because the excesses move what we see as the deficiencies. And if we're looking for virtuous dimensions of a economic theory, a political theory, then we keep track of the extreme, particularly those who are suffering, those who are being most harmed by it. So are there cases where we see people benefiting from neoliberal logics? Undoubtedly, absolutely. But what I want to make sure that we're also doing is keeping track of the harm that's taking place on those polarizing sides of deficiency and excess.
Excellent. Thanks, Dean Walton. Our final question today, we're almost out of time, but it comes from a student, one of my students, Ben Galbraith, who asked, what would you say to that young man today asking about building or expanding his brand?
I hoped nobody would answer that question. Ben asked this question. This is one of your students?
Yeah.
I'm not surprised. You have such brilliant students. I'm not surprised that that's... I was hoping that nobody would ask that question, because I've been racking my brain for a couple of weeks now working on this lecture, thinking of a response. And that's how I wanted to end this lecture. What would I say to him today? And I honestly don't know. I don't know if I have a phrase, a saying that is as cute, memorable, catchy, and thus cliche as my unreflective and sensitive response. And that could be because there's not one. So that's why I ended the way that I did, by suggesting that I understand. And therefore, our responsibility is to pull up that curtain and ask what's really going on with our moral life. And so I don't know if I would have had an answer to that precious young man, but what I can say unequivocally is that I would have corroborated his reality. And in by doing so, I would have acknowledged that I'm complicit in the problem.
Well, thank you, Dean Walton, for helping us see our reality and with your humility, helping us sort of understand how we can better respond to it. We really appreciate both your insight, but also your example. So thank you so much for being with us today.